It's the motherfucking Millennial Miha podcast.
Welcome back to the Millennial Miha podcast. I'm Millennial Miha, and you are listening to Reflections of a Firework. This episode is a behind-the-scenes look back at my book, where I share my personal reflections on the poems I wrote in my 20s. Now that I'm in my 30s, let's see how my perspective has changed. This is Confessions of a Firework, behind the scenes. So as I was reading through the book for the audiobook, like as I was in the booth laying down a track, I felt myself going through, like, I was going through something. And it was crazy because I hadn't read the book as a whole in a very long time, like since I put it together. And because we only had like a limited time to record, so I was forced to just go as quickly through them as I could. But I also wasn't going to allow myself to rush through it in a way where the listener is gonna, like, I don't know, be like cheated out of the experience. So I made it a point to like read it to myself first, and then like read it how I need to say it. Like, this is gonna be how people hear me say these poems. So I wanted to give them their due. So I had to like let myself feel those moments again. And so I realized that I had never learned how to deal with my feelings. Like, I read this and I just felt so bad for that girl. Like, these poems come from when I'm about 20 to like 20, maybe 8, I don't know. I was a hot mess in a lot of ways. And then my dad died. And then that was like a defining moment. So the way the book is set up is in these sections, like these chapters. And I decided that I would put the chapters based on the things that I guess were the most important to me at the time. I'm not really sure what caused me to put them together like this. But I decided that the sections were going to be identity, love, heartbreak, death, growth, and womanhood. When I look back now, I look at the identity section and I see that these are the things that I believed made up my own identity. The first thing is ADHD. So that poem is, you know, me talking to myself because it's an honest list of fears and confessions. And it's like, you know, what if I can't stay around long enough to even become good enough to be great at anything? And I think that what I was struggling with, well, my entire life has been this idea of achieving my potential. Like, there's always, I have always been told that I have unlimited potential by certain people. And I've always felt that also. But I also feel this other part of me that's like weighing me down that doesn't let me be great. And I felt like once I discovered what ADHD was and I got diagnosed with that, I felt that that was one of the things that was holding me back. It's a gift and a curse. And so I definitely had those moments where I was like, I love having ADHD because my mind would work in ways that other people's wouldn't. And so I felt like sometimes I would make it a joke, but then there were really legit times where I was like, oh no, this is an asset. Like, my brain is not like yours, and I'm so glad because you're basic as like, you know, there's moments like that. But then there's also moments of like just feeling really inadequate. And that's what that poem, ADHD, An Honest List of Fears and Confessions, is. It's about all of the ways in which I feel inadequate about myself for having ADHD and a learning disability. And then there's Borderland, which is about me coming to terms with being mixed, with being half Mexican and half Italian, and feeling like I don't fit on either side completely, but also feeling like I don't really know how to be in the middle either, and realizing that there was even a middle ground in the first place. I had read Gloria Anzaldúa in a college class, and I was like, what the fuck is this? I thought it was the best thing I ever wrote. I was like, this is amazing. I had never, ever, 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 ever heard or read a Chicana author like that. Like, that was so radical. Her book, Borderlands, La Frontera, is like a mix between poetry and verse and scholarly article. And like, it's the way the book is written is like nothing I had ever seen before. And so I loved that she code switches from English to Spanish so easily. She talks in like Chicano slang. She talks about all the different kinds of slang. She uses it to tell the story, and she does not distinguish for the reader what is what, because she believes that the reader needs to acclimate to her. She doesn't need to acclimate to the reader because she's just writing her experience, and her experience is multilingual. And it's just, she writes the way she exists. And so that to me was a whole concept that I thought was amazing. And so that, you know, sparked the Borderland poem, which is essentially just about what it feels like to be mixed. Like, you know, mi querida Gloria tells me I am a borderland, a hybrid, a creature of the middle. Yo soy una frontera. I am a borderland. She wants me to celebrate this. Like, this is me just processing what I'm learning. Like, I'm just, this is like, I'm reading this book in class, but then I'm also a poet and I don't know how to talk about my feelings. So I'm going to write a poem if I want to talk about it at all. Yeah. And that poem is me processing that I am not from here, not from there, but I can exist in the middle, and that's okay too. Then there's recovery. As the years have gone by, I have grown to love this poem. I never really did it when I would get asked to do features or universities or big shows or anything, because there was parts of me that knew that there were going to be people in the audience that didn't know what that life was like. So they were going to hear certain buzzwords and use that to judge me off of. Because if I'm to tell people that my parents are heroin addicts, like, people who have no concept of that even being a reality, or like people who went to prison, like if I say that to certain people, they're going to take that with the limited experience they have of that and then try to nail down exactly what I am and who I am in the world. And now the reason why I'm incorporating that poem more and more into my sets is because I don't give a anymore. There's no way they can define me, because I define myself. It doesn't matter where I came from, and it doesn't matter that my parents were heroin addicts, and it doesn't matter that we're still poor. Like, it doesn't matter that I grew up broke. Like, that's the difference. There's a difference between being broke and being poor. Poor is a mentality that few people ever like recover from, but broke is just your situation, you know? And so that's why, like, I think that those things used to try to hide them. But now I'm not anymore, because I'm owning who I am, and that will get me to who I want to be. And so if I choose that I don't want to continue to be broke, then if I just keep doing me and keep working at my craft and what I'm doing and not focusing on anybody else's stuff, then eventually my circumstance will change and I won't be broke anymore. And so I'm finally ready to do that. So I think that's why I'm incorporating that poem more and more into my sets, because I want to own who I am instead of being ashamed of it. Depression and anxiety, those two poems, I mean, are self-explanatory, and there's just so much confusion and pain with, like, these were words that I didn't know before, like, that I think I heard in relation to, like, maybe, like, on TV, depression medication, like, but it was never a word I heard given to me, like, somebody told me what I had, and then, so that's me, like, trying to understand these labels of depression and anxiety, and, like, trying to name what those things look like for me. So, like, I start describing it. And I think for depression, I say, depression is so much more than just being sad. It is the bleeding of the spirit. And, like, that's really what it feels like. It's, like, it's not just I'm having a bad day. It's so much more than that. So that's what I was trying to say, which is what I said. Then there's The Cost of Joy, which I dedicated to Robin Williams, because he took his life, and I know that he struggled for years with depression, but he was also one of the people that brought the most joy and happiness to the world. And that really messed with me. And so it was something that I wanted to acknowledge. And so is The Cost of Joy, because people don't realize, like, they look at him as an entertainer. They don't realize what it costs him to give that much energy, that much of himself away. Like, he goes home at night and probably has nothing left because he gave it all away. And I think that was something I needed to acknowledge. So then there is the love section. And the love section is interesting because the way I thought about love in my 20s, it's just evolved into something better, I think. And just, you're never really better or worse. I think you just either have more perspective or less. And I think now I just have more. Like, the first love poem is about what I imagine, or not what I imagine, what I know at that point in my life love to be. So I talk about how, like, loving someone doesn't mean you understand them. It means you are willing to. Like, this poem is essentially just the things I had learned about love up until now. Like, the things I knew to be true. You know, love is what is left when it is no longer convenient, when it's no longer about the chase, when her makeup is smeared and his feet smell and they have bad attitudes. Like, it's about what happens when you turn off the fairy tale and, like, turn on real life, because I was living with someone at the time. That was just it. I think what my poems essentially are just me recording the things I learned so that hopefully someone else can find them and, like, be like, don't make the same mistake I did. But at the same time, they kind of have to in order to grow. It's by no means a map. It's just a documentation of the way I went, you know? Like, you could go any way you want, but this is how I got there. The next poem is called Brito, and it's about a friend of mine. She was my roommate. Her name is Vanessa, and I love her very much. And it's about the first time I saw her come back from talking about the man she loves. And at this point, we were so young, and she was kind of, like, more closed off from love, and she just wasn't, like, I was ready to jump into anything, and she was just like, no, like, chill. And so she was just much more reserved in that regard and, like, protective of herself. And she just came back with a smile, like, I had finally seen someone come alive, you know? And that was just a really beautiful moment for me, so I wrote a poem about it. And then there's Maybe, and that's a poem about how maybe my friends are right about how I love, like, a skydiver, you know? Like, I let myself fall, like, on purpose because I have so much hope that I guess I wasn't tired of getting hurt yet because it was just starting. So I was like, oh, I still got some bounce in this heart. Like, I could just throw it a couple more times. Like, let's see if it sticks. And my friends would warn me. They warned me a lot. And they were always like, oh, Angie, like, she just has so much hope. Like, it was never looked at as a positive thing. It was always like they were frustrated with me for it, or like they were talking, like, bad about me to me. Like, everything that would happen to me would be my fault, you know? And that was really hurtful. And so I think that, you know, I was trying to say maybe they are right about me. But also, you know, what's wrong with wanting love? Like, that was me posing the question. Like, what's wrong with wanting love? Like, what's wrong with hoping it'll work? Like, why is that so bad? And that's, you know, that's me just posing that question. The next poem in the love section is Falling, which is a poem about a man who really, really loved me, like, really loved me, and knew what it was that we had before I did. And, like, the first line of the poem is, when you tried to catch me the first time, I did not know how to be held. What I meant was that, exactly, I just did not know how to let myself. Like, I didn't know how to let myself appreciate what this was because I had never seen it before. And then when I got it, it was like, oh, this must be too good to be true. And I just kept doubting his love for me. And that was because I think, like, I didn't have any self-love or self-worth. And so I couldn't understand why someone would love me that much. Like, I was used to kind of having to tap dance or, like, do be extra special in order to receive love from someone. You know, this poem is just about all the questions I had for him. Like, will you still be there when you see who I really am? Day, like, will you still just lift me up all the time? Which is something that you would think you would want, right? But I guess when I had it, I was just finding things on purpose to try to self-sabotage it. And so this poem is about that and about all of the ways I was doubting him and why he loved me. The last poem is about a warning letter to the next person who loves me. And it's called There Will Be Poems. And it says, if you are to date a poet, be forewarned, there will be poems. And it's me explaining to the person that comes next that I'm not just a regular person that just says, like, how they feel for whatever reason. Like, so the poems are the way I communicate my feelings, and because I don't really know how to talk about them. And so are you gonna be okay with that? That's basically what this poem is saying. The next section is called Heartbreak. And whoo! This was such a big part of who I was in my 20s, was like, I was like the heartbreak kid, like, except I wasn't breaking hearts, I was getting my heart broken. But actually, I think there definitely were some people who got their hearts broke because I couldn't make up my mind. And also because I did not know how to see a good thing when it was staring me in my face, because I didn't have enough perspective yet. That's really what it comes down to. All of the bad decisions you've ever made, all it really comes down to is you just didn't have enough perspective yet. Like, nobody means to, you know, mess up their lives, but we do sometimes because we don't know any better. You just don't have enough perspective yet. Just try to look at it like that, so you can forgive yourself for things that, you know, have happened in your life that you caused or, you know, played an active role in, but that you wouldn't do those things again now, knowing what you know now. The first poem is When Your Heart is Handed Back to You, and it's a poem about when the guy who I was in love with, that's what it felt like when he didn't love me anymore. Like, it felt like I had given him my heart, like an actual tangible physical thing that you could give someone, and then he took it for a few years, and I really thought it was gonna, you know, be permanent, and then he literally, it felt like, gave it back to me and was like, nah, like, I don't want this, take it back. And it's like, what? How am I supposed to? I'm sorry. And so it's just like really painful to feel like somebody doesn't want you. Like, and it's, and you can't, sometimes you can think of it like, you know, this person doesn't want me because they don't know how great I am. But it's like, oh no, he knew. And he still doesn't want me. That was like the ultimate blow to my ego, mostly. Yeah, that's it. It was just painful. And so there's some beautiful lines in that poem. When your heart is handed back to you, do not look down at it. Do not squeeze it or throw it on the floor or step on it with angry feet. Do not lose your mind or try to make him lose his. Do not throw it back at him, hoping he will catch it. He won't. His palms are not even big enough to hold his own. When your heart is handed back to you, do not put it in the freezer. Do not hold it in your warm hands and watch the condensation create a puddle for it to swim in. Do not stand there numb, eyes wide and lips parted, hoping he will change his mind. He won't. And I just go on to just like, I guess it's like all of these poems are just warnings to whoever's gonna go through this next. Like, don't do it. Don't try to make him stay because he's already gone, honey. Like, he's already gone. And I wish, these are, I guess, things I wish I could have said to myself, or things I wish someone would have told me. Like, these poems are all of those things. Then this is another one of my old faithfuls. It's Things to Keep in Mind When Your Heart is Broken. And I really liked this poem. I was really into making list poems at the time. I think every poet goes through this list poem phase, especially like, you know, coming up in the Poetry Lounge and like that scene. That was like a popular format for a while. And so I tried it, but I tried it with the thing that I had in my arsenal, which is being heartbroken. So I was like, okay, things to keep in mind when your heart is broken. And that, like, I just went with the formula. And it's like, it's called a breakup because it's broken. You can't make them stay. You shouldn't want to. Like, you know, like when they're ready to leave, help them pack. Like, don't be like, let people go, you know, like, it's okay to let people go. And it's okay to not want someone who does not want you. Like, you don't have to keep fighting. And I wished someone would have said that to me, but it was a lesson I had to learn on my own. And so that's what this poem is about. And I really like performing this poem because there's a lot of like comedic moments, and it's me being real. But like I say, in the weeks following a breakup, do not torture yourself. Listening to Adele is not therapy. It is self-inflicted torture. Like, I would do that to myself. I would really sit there and listen to sad music, which I know a lot of us do, you know, but it was almost like I liked the torment of being heartbroken in this weird way, like a forever sad girl. I don't know. Then there's The Shape of Your Back. And this poem, I really liked the imagery. Because, the first line is, I have memorized the shape of your back, the way your footsteps sound walking opposite my direction. I could pick out the back of your head in a crowded room. So it's an extended metaphor comparing the way you feel to seeing someone's back of their head all the time is because they always want to leave you. And so it, like, keeps going throughout the poem. And I like the way that it fit because it was so fitting because the last poem, the last line is, always trying to keep things that simply do not want to be kept. Like, I'm always trying to do the opposite thing of what just is happening. Like, I can't just let things happen. Like, if someone's walking away, like, just let them go. Like, you don't have to run after them. And I didn't know that because I was always looking at every person that walked out of my life as the last person who would ever love me. And that is completely false. It's a false way to look at things, but it comes from being raised in a situation where nothing is permanent, you know? And that's kind of like the way things around me were. Like, we moved around a lot. Like, I moved around 8 times before I was 10. And it just, when the number goes like way after that, you know, but it's like, just that alone is really traumatic for a kid, and then going from like different situations of being broke in each scenario. And so I think that there's just a lot of me, my inability to deal with people abandoning me, or me perceiving everybody leaving as an abandonment, as opposed to like, oh, this just didn't work out and that's okay. And so that's what I kind of wish I would have known. Then there is The Death of the Forest. And this poem is about, it's about one of the breakups I have already mentioned, but it's basically our love story. In my mind, the metaphor of the forest was our love. Like, we had, it wasn't just like most people's love is just a tree, you know, but ours was a forest. Like, that's how I looked at it. That's how he seemed to look at it. And that's how everybody looked at it. Like, we were kind of lifted up in these spaces of like these community spaces that we were in as this like exemplary couple of like how happy we were and how we treated each other and how, you know, how in love we were. Like, it was just like a running common thing for people just to call us, you know, like power couple or whatever. And like, and that was like a little narrative that I really liked, because it went along with the narrative I had of what I wanted in my head. And so I just, you know, we went along with it. And so for me, I felt like it was way more than it was, which is a tendency that I have, which is to put dubs on stuff, like, or just like everything's more, holds more weight than it actually holds. And that's because I let it in my head. And so this poem is like our love story about how, you know, people watched, marveled at our green thumbs, trees grew tall and wise. We secured tire swings, put up wind chimes, built our house beneath the shade. We feasted on the fruits that blossomed above us. We made a home of that forest. I thought we were going to stay there forever. But this marrowless bone salvaged from the mangled corpse that became of us. This orphan branch is all that is left. This lifeless limb is the only proof I have that a forest once stood here. So it's like everything got burned down and all that's left is a branch. And like, I'm the branch. I was the branch in this situation. And yeah, it's really heart-wrenching to like reread this. And I don't know if it is for other people, because this is also not a poem that I do a lot. Like, I don't really perform it, simply because it's really long. And it's also just like really sad. Like, Jesus, I feel bad for you, homegirl. Like, you gotta get counseling. Which I did. And then there is Throwing Away His Toothbrush. And this poem for me is like the final act of letting go. It's me, you know, like acknowledging that he won't be coming back. And I, you know, the days after we broke up, I like held on to his toothbrush. I think I held on to it for like weeks, actually, before I was ready to face the reality that he wasn't coming back. So there's no reason to have an extra toothbrush in the thing. Like, he's not coming back. And that was really hard and difficult, but it was also very liberating. And so I think that that was like a physical act, a physical thing that I did, that had a really emotional impact on the inside. So that's why it was something that I decided to write about, because it was something so small that had such a big impact. And that those are the poems that I think are very powerful most of the time, because it is these very insignificant, minute details of our lives that we think in the moment that end up later being these huge milestones. And we don't ever realize it as it's happening. And it's always usually, again, with more perspective. The last poem in the section is called In the End. And it's about how when you fall out of love with someone, or there's a breakup and, you know, it ends, and you're all messed up from it. And so I compare myself to a stick of gum. It says, when the last bits of me have lost all their flavor and I am nothing more than a forgettable trace of an old stick of gum stuck to the bottom of your shoe, the women will be here to scrape me off. And it's just about how I'm going to be all right. I'm going to be all right, because I have this community of women around me, which at the time I did, and it was so beautiful and so encouraging to have those friends around me at that time, because I felt like I might not have anything else, but at least I have that, you know? And that's how I felt, and that's really why I wrote the poem, right? That's really the reason why I wrote this poem. The next section is death. It's about the loss of my father in 2011. He died from cirrhosis of the liver. And I found him on my birthday and took him to the hospital. And he died 4 days later. We took him off life support. And so the first poem in the section is called January 20th, which is my birthday. And it just details that incident. And it, I think it does a good job of just how I felt in that that specific moment. Because, you know, like I'd say I went home, I sunk into the couch and never wanted to breathe the same way again. All I felt were deep waves of pain followed by loud silence. And this concept of loud silence, I had never even thought those two things could go together until my father died. Like, until grief really got introduced into my life, because it was like the silence was the pain. Like, I had to listen to myself, like, oh my God, I don't have a father anymore and I'll never do this or that. And that was too painful. So I decided to do other things. Like, I decided to, I say in this poem, I still do not know where I'm supposed to put all of this pain, so I wear it heavy, the only way I know how, silent, the way most pain tends to torture. So I fake it, the weight this deserved is too heavy to bear all at once, so I fill the void with poetry and people and places, there is always somewhere to go. Can't sit with myself for too long, maybe I know what that will mean. And what I'm saying is that the silence was too painful, because then I had to think about it, because the silence is where you think about things and where you have to face reality of what's actually going on. But if you keep yourself busy and you ignore it, then you don't have to face those. But that comes back to bite you later, and that's for sure it will. And so that's why grief is... I wish in these poems that I had more perspective, because then I could have said, this is the way I'm feeling, but this is what you should do. But that's not what I said, because I didn't have that as a tool yet. I didn't know how to process my grief. I didn't even know there was such thing as a grief counselor. I didn't even know that that was even available. And so, you know, I didn't really know that when I wrote this poem, but I want to say that if you're going through grief, you have to find a way to process it. Like, you have to let it out. Otherwise, it will destroy you from the inside out. And it did that to me. And so it made me do things that I would have never done before, like drink and drive. Later on in the book, you'll hear a poem about me doing that and, you know, almost killing myself. And so I just want to say, for anyone who's dealing with grief, to please find a healthy way to deal with it. And that is not drugs. That is not alcohol. And that is not sex, because those are the things I tried to use to numb the pain, and it didn't work. It didn't work. The next poem is to the daughters who will lose their fathers too soon. And this poem is like, I have to be in a certain kind of mood to be able to do it. Like, I feel sometimes like I have to like disassociate in a way to like not feel the pain of this poem. But it's just about how like we... Because I had this friend who had also lost her father before I lost mine. And so she was able to kind of be there for me in the moments, like on the special days, like on Father's Day or whatever. We would talk or text each other, or on his birthday or my birthday. And there was someone who I was like, oh, she at least gets it, like in a way that other people just can't get it unless that's happened to them. And so it was this idea that we had become this sisterhood that nobody wanted to join, you know, like of all these people who understood each other, who were this part of this club that like we're daughters of death. Like we'll not know our lives anymore without that like cloud. And this is specifically to people who knew their fathers, or to people who were close with them or liked, or, you know, you at least had a decent relationship to where you were like, oh, nah, forget him. Like, great. I'm glad he's gone. You know, that's a whole different... I can't speak to that experience. I can only speak to my own. And so I think that this poem is really detailed in... It just details my experience of, like, grieving. And so I talk about, I think the most powerful point in this poem is, it says, one day you will see a little girl and her father in the airport, and you will stare at them holding hands. You will stare until the tears come, and you will have to convince yourself not to walk over. You will want to warn her that her hands will not be small enough to fit into the palms of his forever, and to hold on to them as long as she can. But you won't. You will only stare, and you will find that you stare too long. Not everything these days, not only at little girls and their fathers in airports, but at anything that reminds you that yours is gone. And I think that that part is powerful because it's true. It happened. That was me. Like, I found myself stuck in an airport just, like, staring at this little girl. And I was like, if she only knew, like, I hope she's enjoying it because it could be gone at any moment. And that was really painful. But I like the image because it's easy to picture. You know, I like using it in my writing because it's easy for me to paint that picture because it's a relatable image. And so I believe that's important in writing, is to be able to use things. There are some moments where I do use some, like, metaphors where some people might be like, what is she talking about? But then there are other points in my writing, which I really like about my writing, that are very clean and simple, like no flowery language whatsoever, just saying exactly what happened. And sometimes that's beautiful, more beautiful than making up a metaphor. So I think that the next poem is called Dear Daddy, and it's a letter to my dad, and it's just me, what I would say to him if I could talk to him one last time. And you know, I just kind of say these things that I would never say out loud, like, Dear Daddy, I'm sorry I don't miss you enough. No one gets it. And I think when I say, I'm sorry, I don't miss you enough, it's like, I won't let myself, because I don't want to die. Like, I felt like I was going to, if I let myself even feel the amount of pain that I was going to feel, I was not going to be able to handle it. So I just let it out. Like, each poem would be like just a little bit more of a release, but I would never let it all come out because I was scared. And, you know, I say things like, sometimes I think having you back would solve everything. Maybe then it wouldn't hurt so much. Maybe then I wouldn't feel so empty. Maybe then I would look forward to Thanksgiving again instead of dreading it. So you could tell jokes and my mom could roll her eyes at you. And me and my sisters could laugh and eat and laugh and eat. But it's just us now. And I wish I can say that is enough, but it's not. It's just not. And that's what I meant about, you know, talking about just saying exactly what it is. Like, I didn't use any, there's no metaphor there because there's no other way to say that. It's just not enough. And because someone's absent from your life, you know, and they're never coming back, and you have to figure out a way to reconcile with that. So it took me all the way to get to the growth part to realize that I haven't spoken at all about the Gloria and the Lua quotes that I have before every chapter. But this next chapter is called Growth. And so Growth begins with a Gloria and the Lua quote that's, it says, why am I compelled to write? Because the world I create in the writing compensates for what the real world does not give me. By writing, I put in order the world, give it a handle so I can grasp it, to discover myself, to preserve myself, to make myself, to convince myself that I am worthy and that what I have to say is not a pile of shit. Finally, I write because I'm scared of writing, but I'm more scared of not writing. So the poems in this section are about things that I had to grow from. You know, they're about... you know, a letter to myself at 14 is about the story of me being in a physically abusive relationship, you know, 3 years of high school, and what that was like. And it's just really detailed, I guess. And I feel like it's a long poem, but it's like what happens when I write a poem is like I don't tend to come back and revisit it. So I need to say everything I have to say, like, in that poem. And I just have to get it all out so I don't have to talk about it anymore. And so I think that's why a lot of my poems, the ones that are about, like, big stuff for me, are longer. Some lessons take a long time to learn, you know? The next poem after that is Nazarenes Don't Dance. So what it's about is about my mission trip to Ecuador when I was 14 years old. And I was part of this church that was... a mostly white church, and I just really, it was mostly white and affluent people, and I was not accepted as neither of those things. And so it was like I was always trying to fit in with people there and to change myself to try and pretend like I liked things that I didn't really like, because I wanted to be accepted. And so this poem is about the story of when I went to Ecuador, because I had to do working programs. Like, I had to go to people's houses, like from the church, in order to pay for my trip over there, like the plane and everything. I had to work because all the other kids' families just, like, you know, put a $2,000 check down, but I didn't have that option. So I had to go and do just different things at people's houses. And that was always kind of something that I would get made fun of for. Like, they would find a way to bring that up. Like, I was the help type of thing. And so, anyway, that's a whole other story that I'm trying to tell right now. So, Nazarenes Don't Dance is about how I remember being a Christian once. Like, there was a point in my life where I really called myself a Christian and thought that that was something that I wanted to accept, until there was a moment on the trip to Ecuador that I realized I really did not know anything. I didn't know enough to accept this title of being a Christian as part of my identity, because there was a moment in the poem where I was being pulled in the direction of this, like, friendship circle by this little girl who was, we were in the rainforest, and it was like they were like these indigenous people from this this forest that we were in, and it was just like really dope to even be there and experience that. But as I was being pulled in the direction to go dance with them, my pastor grabbed my arm and was like, "Oh, we don't dance. Like, you can't do that. Where are you going? You can't do that. We don't dance." And I was like, "You don't dance. Like, I dance." And it was the idea, the concept to me, that I really knew so little about this thing called being Nazarene, or this thing being called Christian, that I didn't even know that I wasn't allowed to dance. And I had already gotten baptized in the church, like, thinking that I was just gonna live this whole Christian life, and that is so not what happened. And so this poem is just about how he says, "Angie, no, we're Nazarenes don't dance." And with that, I set the tone for the rest of my life. I danced anyway. And I think that that was where I really learned that I want to always know that I'm thinking for myself. I don't like to be like anyone else. I embrace my otherness or my differentness almost to the point where I amplify it sometimes. And that in my life has meant a lot of different things. It has meant that I wear brightly colored clothing, or that my lipstick's always just a little bit too purple, or it's just like something just a little bit exaggerated. And that's always been how I like it, because I feel like it helps me reflect my personality. And so but it's also something that, you know, I got made fun of for just being extra in a lot of different ways. Like, you could literally apply that to any category, and someone has probably complained that I was too extra emotionally, just in a lot of different ways. And so I want to always know that I'm thinking for myself, and that I'm making my own decisions, and I'm not doing things because that's what the majority of people are doing. I'm fine with it if I like something that, you know, the majority of people like, I don't know, Beyonce. But that's also because I actually listen to her music. I actually know it. I'm not just saying I like it or trying to be a part of something that I don't actually believe in or identify with or actually like. And so that's always been really important to me, just to be my own person. But in the poem where I say I set the tone for the rest of my life and I danced anyway, I think that's really an example of who I became and who I am coming more into every single day, being 31, you know, and revisiting these poems. I'm starting to see where these moments made me who I am. And it's taken a long time to blossom, but you do blossom, and I want people to know that. The next poem in the growth section is Confessions of a Drunk Driver. This poem is about my experience of trying to deal with my grief of losing my father, trying to self-medicate with alcohol, the decisions I made as a result of choosing not to deal with my grief, That's what this poem is. And so it is me taking responsibility for the fact that I could have killed myself and another person. It's me taking responsibility for my guilt and admitting that I was trying to self-medicate with alcohol, and that wasn't the way. That just was not the way. I say in the poem, this poem is everything I'm too ashamed to be out loud. A pathetic attempt at redemption, a message to anyone who needs it, an apology to everyone I've hurt, myself included, by not dealing with this sooner. And last but not least, it's an apology to anyone reading this, because you just as easily could have been that fence, and I am sorry. And so the story is that I hit a fence, or my car got out of control, and I was getting off an exit, and my car went out of control, but I was drunk, and I hit a fence that was separating the street from the overpass, the freeway overpass. And so I broke the fence, and the fence basically like totaled my entire car. But if it wouldn't have been for that fence, I would have gone straight over the overpass, and I'm sure I would have been killed instantly. But yeah, it's an apology. This poem is a lot of different things. I think it's, yeah, it is a attempt at redemption. It's a message. It's an apology. It's also an acceptance of my responsibility. So yeah, this poem is hugely about growth and definitely belongs in this section. Then the next poem is, I wonder if I am crazy. And, there it goes again with that, just straight to the point. I think looking back, I can now say that this poem is about me starting to realize that I have bipolar tendencies, or that my mental health is not like anyone else's around me. Like, I'm starting to see that the way I deal with things is considered destructive, considered reckless, is considered dangerous, and just like abnormal compared to the people around me who, when they would face certain conflict in their life, they would not react the same way I would. And so I ask, you know, like, I'm just worried that I'm questioning the fact that most people don't live like this, questioning their balance and having to wonder whether or not they are a threat to themselves or others. And, you know, I feel so confused and conflicted about it. And in this poem, I'm trying to figure that out. The next poem is called If There Is a God, This Is For You. And I think that this poem is me trying to get to know God outside of church, because I think that when I decided to leave when we got back from the Ecuador trip, and I didn't even go back to church that very week. Like, the next day was Sunday, and I think we were supposed to go back to this welcome ceremony. I didn't even go to that because I was done. I had realized that was not for me. And I'm pretty good at least that. Like, once I make up my mind, no one can change it. But I have to get there. And sometimes it takes me a long time to get there. But that was kind of like an instant in that moment. When he told me I couldn't dance, when he told me that I couldn't partake in like such a beautiful transformational experience, like he was going to limit me of that experience because his religion told him to, I was like, I don't want to be a part of that. Like, that's not even something that I can even pretend that's I would be willing to do. I'm not down. And so so I think this poem, If There Is a God, This Is For You, is me trying to get to know God in my own language, like not in the ways that they would pray at church, and that I would find myself trying to pray like that at home, or thinking that that was the only way, you know, like, because when you become part of a community, you start to inherit little traits or little sayings or the way things are done, and you do them like that too. But I felt that that was clouding my relationship with whatever God there was, because I was experiencing God through someone else's lens. And I didn't have, again, enough perspective yet to be able to figure out a personal relationship with God that I was looking for. And so this poem, it's literally starts out like this. Hi, I know we haven't talked in a while, or maybe I just haven't talked back. Maybe I just don't know what to say. I mean, even if I tried to reply, most of my prayers would be questions anyway. Is that okay? Like, what am I doing here? Is there even a point? Like, why did you give me the desire to create and then make me into someone who always feels so inadequate? Like, these are real questions. Like, I really want to know the answers to these questions. And, you know, like, I like this poem because it's me really just keeping it real with God. And I think that that has always been difficult for me because I thought it had to sound all these different types of ways. I thought it had to be like really respectful and really proper. And I didn't realize that God was inside of me. And so me talking to God, it doesn't matter what language I speak or how I say it, he's going to hear me if that's what I believe to be true, you know? And so I think that that was just me trying to get to know God outside of church. The last chapter in the book is called Womanhood. And obviously it's all about being a woman or becoming a woman or whatever it was in that moment as my 21, 22, 23 year old self is trying to reconcile with what it means to be a woman because I hadn't figured it out yet. And so in the first poem on being a woman, I compare the concept of femininity and a lot of the identifiers of femininity, I compare it with identifiers that are also associated with war and soldiers. And I think the idea is that femininity is a lot more aggressive than it's perceived to be. And so I say things like, what do men know of war, of lipstick and landmines, of contingency plans, plotting and plucking, straightening and strategies, high heels and hostility? What do men know of surrender? And when I say these words like surrender, because surrender in a war is a completely different thing, at least people think it is, of what it means to surrender in a relationship. And those things can be equally destructive. Like, you know, like it can be the end of someone's world if you surrender to the wrong kind of person. And that's what I just feel like women don't get enough credit for, you know, like their lack of physical strength, supposedly. We make up for an emotional strength, like whatever, if there is a lack, because in some women there's not. So there are some women who are just as strong as men, and that's a fact, honey. The next poem is called Women and Wolves. And this is, again, me trying to reconcile this feminine energy with also being dangerous and aggressive. And these are two things that are equally true for me in my life at this time. Like, I love being very hyper feminine and I love getting ready and doing all these things, but I also am aggressive in a lot of ways. That can be with my personality, but it can also be physically. Like, I am not a stranger to fighting. Like, when I was in high school, that was something that was just part of who I was because I had, you know, unprocessed anger. But also, like, I never looked at myself as this little, like, flower. A flower that couldn't, you know, take care of herself. Like, that was never me. Although people might look at me and think that because I present as hyper feminine. And so this poem is comparing women and wolves. So I say, wild women and wolves are made of the same magic. Creatures of instinct, fierce and enigmatic, both labeled dangerous and made to feel ashamed of being what they are. And it just talks about how to use our inside voices. People taught us to be polite, to be ladylike. To be ladylike means to quiet the growls, to silence the hunger pains of a starved soul. And it just talks about how being a woman is, it's in the comparison of it being a wolf. Like, you look at a wolf and that's the most beautiful animal. Like, they're so beautiful, but they are dangerous. And don't you ever forget it. And that's what I think I was trying to say in that poem. The next poem is called Boobs Versus Brains. And this is one of my old faithfuls. And the reason why I like doing this poem is because it's the first time I feel like I found exactly what I wanted to say for a moment that happened. There's a lot of things called microaggressions. And if you don't already know what that is, it is it's little things that happen in life that where people treat you differently or say things to you that don't make you feel good. And you know that that doesn't feel good, but you also are unsure of whether or not that was racist or sexist, or because it's not concrete, but it's, it can, you can feel it. And this was a moment in this poem, Boobs Versus Brains, where I had walked into an administrator's office when I was in college, and I needed some paperwork done, and he looked at me and the way I was dressed and was surprised at the major that I had, which was, you know, rhetoric and mostly philosophy. And he was surprised at that because the way I looked didn't match up with what he thought someone who studied philosophy would look like. And he made this comment that was very hurtful, but I didn't allow it to hurt me. Like, I want to use my femininity as a weapon. Like, I believe it's a strength, not a weakness. And that's what this poem is really talking to, or speaking to, is just the idea that femininity is not a weakness, it's an asset. And my favorite line in this poem, and it's every single time I read it, someone responds, and it's, I always been told you don't bite the hand that feeds you. What you do is wait until you're full, and then you burn down the fucking kitchen. And so I love that line because it's straight to the point, but it's also concise. Like, it's clever. It's clever, but it is exactly the way my mother would have told me to do it. Like, she would have been like, yeah, you do. You sit there and you wait for him to do the grad check. You don't pop off on him before that. You have to get what you came for, but also let him know that you're not the one. Like, but you don't jeopardize your situation. Like, because of a little microaggression, like the thing he said to me, like, oh, you know, I would have thought that you'd be interested in more feminine things. That wasn't means for me to go crazy on him. But my way of getting back to him was writing this poem, because this poem is going to live forever. Like, I don't know what he's doing now. Who knows what happened to him? But I know that this moment affected me in a positive way, because I made it empower me instead of letting it destroy me. And I think that was one of the first times where I was able to do that, to turn this anger or emotion into fuel to create something. And that is what I really love about this poem. And that's why it's so empowering, because I was taking my power, back, but because I wasn't giving it to him in the first place. And so I love that there's some great lines in this poem, like, see, I wear my womanhood proud. I wear it ball gown, lipstick, mascara, and blush. Do not ask me to tone that down so that your life can make more sense. I will not be less me so that you can feel more comfortable being more you. And I will not play small to serve you or your assumptions of what hobbies I should have simply because you find me attractive. And that's pretty much just straight to the point. Like, that's what I also like about, I keep seeing this, you know, pattern in my writing, of the writing I like most for myself is not the poems where I put a lot of metaphors or a lot of flowery language. The poems that I like the most that I've written are the ones that get straight to the point. And I think that that's closer to who I am. But when I was writing those flowery poems, I was unsure of what they would mean later. You know, I don't feel as connected to them because I didn't know who I was yet. And I thought that poems were supposed to sound a certain way. And so there's still some good content in there, but I think that some of them, they're not as poignant to me as the ones with direct language. The next poem is When She Brings the Wind. And this poem is an example of the flowery language and the extended metaphor, because I compare women to natural disasters. And it's really about this, you know, deep primordial power that women have. And I never really knew or looked at how good that poem was. It's kind of like it's like my version of the quote, hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. And this poem is me trying to say that in my own words. And so, like, a couple lines are, when she brings the wind from the cyclone in her chest and throat, you will be sorry. When she brings the wind from the hellfire of her heavy heart, it will be an untamed power you could not prepare for, a power you cannot see, and one you cannot ignore. Like, I'm not playing. Like, women are not playing. Like, you guys don't understand, whoever is underestimating us, what we're capable of. And that's what I feel that I was trying to convey in this poem. The last poem Well, let's all just take a breath because that was a lot. And this has been a lot. This whole project from recording the audiobook to recording this reflection on the audiobook, this has been an emotionally draining experience because I'm having to relive these moments over again. But I feel like the first time I released this book in 2016, that I did not pay it the attention that it deserved. I didn't look at it as this thing that I tried to market because I still at the time didn't believe in myself. And so I'm ready to do that now, but that means that I'm ready to do the work. And when I say the work, in this case, it means the emotional labor that it takes to actually look and reflect on who I was and who I am now and what that means, and look at it with perspective. So the last poem is called I Do Not Wish to Die Whole. And this poem is about who I want to be at the end of my life. And I want to be someone who gave so freely of herself that, you know, I have nothing left. And I want to be able to say that everything that I received, every blessing I received, I gave it back to you, or I gave it away, because it was never really mine. Like, all of the things, the experiences, they were mine as they happened. But then once I wrote about them and put them in a book and sent them out into the world, then they became yours. And they became, they were given new life by the different people who read them. And that's what I mean about this poem, is that I don't wish to die whole, meaning I don't want there to be anything left. I want to be able to say that in the poem it says, I want to be able to say that I was a woman who learned to tame fear, who in the end learned to treat it as nothing more than a dare, a divine challenge, a test to see if she was worthy of heaven. And she was. She really was. When I die, I will not be alone. I will take with me my demons. I will dance with them. And when they start to grow too large, I will draw from my artillery, my mother's spirit, my father's courage, and every single poem I have birthed in the name of love. Even in death, my art will keep me safe. I will have learned to let it do this for me. And so this poem is a love letter to the universe, hoping and putting it out there, trying to manifest this woman who eventually figures it all out. You know, although this book was heavy and although there were so many experiences in it that were transformative for me, this last poem is me hoping that this matters in the end, that because I wrote all these poems and because I created all of this work, that it matters. And so when I go, it will be okay. I will be fine with that because I did with my life the best that I could. And that was to serve and to be of service to others and to use my experience and the things I've gone through, good and bad, to teach, because that's what I feel I was put on earth to do. Thank you so much for listening to this. This has been my reflection. I know it was long and I know it was pretty rough. But we got through it together. And so, again, thank you for listening.
Hello? It's the Motherfucking Millennial Mija Podcast.